Hey everyone, this is Sue Marks with Food Thoughts. Hope you're doing great. Time marches on. It is November already. Are you? And it's also cold. It finally got cold. So here we are. I guess it's called bring it on. You know, it's time for that. So we had warmth for so long. We just kind of not used to it. At any rate, I want to finish reading these a couple recipes from this Bon Appetit, a couple magazines from them. They're really great. Are you ready? 6 degrees of chicken cutlet. Can't tell your marsala from your saltimbocca? We are here to help. How many ways can you possibly cook a pounded thin chicken breast? Well, as any self-respecting red sauce menu will tell you, the answer is a lot. The chicken cutlet is the stem cell of the kitchen. The stuff of life itself, a base protein that can, depending how you cook and sauce it, morph into a seemingly boundless array of codified, canonical Italian-American dishes. Marsala, Milanese, Francese, but what does it all mean? What distinguishes chicken parmigiana from piccata? With the help of the fine folks at Detroit's iconic Amore de Roma, we break it down. So, number one, marsala, lightly floured, sautéed and served in a rich, silky pan sauce composed of butter, onions, caramelized mushrooms, and plenty of marsala, the sherry-esque fortified wine from coastal Sicily. Number two, parmigiana, crunchy cutlets, gilded with a thin layer of marinara and a flurry of grated parmesan. And for the non-purists, a blanket of mozzarella, broiled to perfection. Does not get much more iconic than this. Number three, piccata, which is beautiful. Less crunchy, more saucy. And no breadcrumbs this time. Instead, slices of chicken get dredged in seasoned flour, sautéed in butter, smothered in an addictively tangy lemon butter pan sauce studded with salty capers. Want to make it in the comfort of your own home? You can do it. Francese, also known as chicken French, this baby comes in a sauce similar to piccata, but without the capers, and it also stands apart for its uncrisp texture. Cutlets get dipped in wet batter for an eggy, almost puffy exterior. Saltimbocca. Cutlets are pounded out, layered with prosciutto and sage, rolled into tiny little packages, sometimes not always, then dredged in flour and sautéed. The name literally translates to jumps in the mouth. Doesn't that sound good? And finally, Milanese. The cutlet simplicity of it at its finest. A crisp slab of breaded and pan-fried chicken breast. No sauce in sight. Maybe a wedge of lemon or tuft of dressed arugula riding side saddle. Do not call it a schnitzel. Why I Had to Leave New York to Learn to Love Red Sauce by Brett Martin. I grew up in Red Sauce Heaven, a largely Italian-American neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York. Meatballs, ziti, calzones, and parmes of every variety were staples of my young diet. Then, as happens, I started to get ideas. First, there was a new restaurant my family referred to simply as the Northern Italian Place. It offered strange dishes like risotto and veal Milanese that were decidedly not red. My concept of sophistication in those days was entirely color-based. Then came the dining revolution that put all the diverse regional cuisines of Italy front and center in America's restaurant culture. This, I thought, was real Italian, nudi and malfatti and herb-roasted branzino. I had left childish things behind, but as they say, just when I thought I was out. 8 years ago, I moved to New Orleans. Of all the dishes I anticipated stuffing myself with in my new home, po' boys, crawfish, beignets, speckled trout, Italian ones did not even cross my mind. This turned out to be a major blind spot. The influence of Southern Italian food on New Orleans cuisine is as overlooked by outsiders as its supposed French influences are vastly overstated. Similarly, the distinctive look of the French Quarter is actually a remnant of Spanish rule. Sicilians began arriving in New Orleans as early as the 1830s and continued to flood in well into the beginning of the 20th century. Part of the same melange of immigrants that makes the New Orleans accent sound strikingly like it's been imported from the Bronx. Their legacy is hiding in plain sight, broadcast in the names of some of the city's most iconic neighborhood food businesses: Domolise's Poor Boys, Casamento's John Genduza Bakery, Angela Broccato Original Italian Ice Cream Parlor. The highest profile Southern Italian specialty in town is probably the muffuletta, a sandwich of salamis, hams, and cheeses, slicked with a layer of briny olive salad and pressed between the horizontally split halves of a large, spongy Sicilian loaf. But there are dozens of other delicacies as integral to the New Orleans landscape. I'm thinking of fat artichokes, laboriously stuffed with breadcrumbs and seasoned until they are more bread than vegetable. Or the anise-scented pine nut cookies you find on St. Joseph's Day altars every March. Of iceberg lettuce covered in olives, anchovies, and asparagus, drowning in a sea of vinaigrette, a dish that, until shockingly recently, was still often referred to on many menus with an ethnic slur, but now mostly appears simply as Italian salad. I'm thinking of the pilgrimage to Mosca's, the legendary outpost and reputed mob hangout, way out across the river in West Wego for chicken a la grande, swimming in olive oil, rosemary, and garlic. Or to the shore of Lake Pontchartrain for R&O Restaurant's Italian Special, a combo meatball and sausage po' boy. Of Eggplant Tina, a square of thin layered eggplant and cheese once served at the late lamented Tony Agnello's and now revived Nephew's, opened by a relative in the suburb of Metairie. Of Veal Ocean, a pounded cutlet striped like a slab of Neapolitan ice cream with crab, shrimp, and crawfish sauces at Adolfo's, perched over crowds of concert goers on Frenchman Street. All of these fall under the umbrella label Creole Italian, though the degree of Creole can wax and wane. A touch of extra spice in the sauce, a drop of Pernod in the baked oysters, the use of Gulf fish and shrimp. As in many aspects of New Orleans cuisine, sorting out who influenced whom in what proportions and vice versa can be a futile endeavor. Ultimately, you throw up your hands and just eat. Mangi, mangi. Above all, and often literally on top of all, there's red gravy, the local version of what New Yorkers know as the sauce. It tends to be sweeter here, brighter red and more one-dimensional, if truth be told, but perfect for its highest purpose, which is dressing a plate of noodles topped with meatballs. For me, the platonic ideal is served at Mandina's, the garlicky meatballs roughly the size of tennis balls, the sauce a shade of red in which you might order a convertible. This is my heart's emoji of Italian food. I've eaten twice as many meatballs in the 8 years I've lived in New Orleans than I did in the previous 30 I spent in Brooklyn. Part of it is simply the pleasure of meeting an old friend in a different context. Part is growing up and shedding youthful pretensions. But maybe, like so many things, red sauce is just easier in New Orleans than it is in New York. It's not a class signifier. It's not trendy or untrendy, not cool or uncool, ironic or referential, like the spate of expensive neo-red sauce joints that have popped up in recent years. It is only, as it has always been, delicious. And then there's this beautiful picture of some baked cannelloni. Until my dad took me to Providence's Federal Hill, a little Italy packed with red sauce royalty like Joe Marzilli's old canteen, I never knew cannelloni could be so good. Nor did I understand the power of white sauce, a.k.a. bechamel. My version packs in sausages, ricotta, chard, and plenty of creamy, creamy bechamel. So let's see if we can find that recipe. Yes, sausage and ricotta baked cannelloni. Makes 8 servings. We're all for a good store-bought marinara, especially in a recipe with multiple parts, but there is no substitute for homemade bechamel. Of this we can be sure. So here's the recipe for the bechamel, the white sauce. 6 tablespoons unsalted butter, 3 tablespoons all-purpose flour, 3 cups whole milk, 1 ounce Parmesan grated about 1/2 cup, 1 pinch of cayenne pepper, 1 pinch of ground nutmeg, and some kosher salt. For the assembly, 2 All right, well, let's make the bechamel. Melt the butter in a medium saucepan over medium heat. Whisk in the flour and cook, whisking occasionally until the mixture smells slightly nutty, about 3 minutes. Whisk in the milk, then increase the heat to medium-high and still whisking constantly. Bring to a simmer. Reduce heat to maintain a simmer and cook just until thick and no longer floury tasting, 8 to 10 minutes. Add Parmesan and whisk until melted, then whisk in the cayenne and the nutmeg, season with salt. Cover the bechamel and keep warm until ready to use. And if you want to do ahead, bechamel can be made 3 days ahead. Let cool, cover, and chill. Reheat over medium-low, whisking constantly and adding a splash of water if needed to loosen. Okay, so the rest is assembly. 2 bunches green Swiss chard, 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 1 pound sweet Italian sausage, casings removed, 1 pound whole milk fresh ricotta, some kosher salt, 1 pound fresh pasta sheets, about 16 6x4-inch pieces, or 12 ounces dried jumbo shells, about 30 of them. 2 cups store-bought marinara sauce, and then grated Parmesan for sprinkling. So, remove the ribs and stems from the Swiss chard leaves and thinly slice. Tear leaves into large pieces. Combine oil and sausage with Swiss chard ribs and stems in a large skillet and set over medium-high heat. Cook, breaking up the sausage with a heat-proof rubber spatula or wooden spoon into small pieces. Until the sausage is almost cooked through, 5 to 7 minutes. Add the Swiss chard leaves to the skillet a handful at a time, tossing and letting them wilt slightly between additions until all of the leaves have been added. Cook, reducing heat as needed. Liquid should be bubbling slightly at this point until the liquid is almost completely evaporated. It's important to dry out the Swiss chard here so the filling is not soggy. About 5 minutes. Transfer to a large bowl, let it cool 5 minutes, then stir in the ricotta. Season the filling with salt. If using pasta sheets, cook in a pot of boiling salted water for 1 minute. Transfer to a large bowl of cold water. Lay out a row of pasta sheets on a rimmed baking sheet. Do not overlap. Then top with a sheet of waxed or parchment paper. Remove with remaining pasta sheets, placing sheets of paper between each layer. Repeat with remaining pasta sheets, placing sheets of paper between each layer. If you're using shells, cook in a pot of boiling salted water, stirring occasionally just until very al dente, about 3 minutes less than package directions. Rinse under cold water to cool completely. So now we preheat the oven to 375. Spread half of the bechamel into a 13x9-inch baking dish. If you're using the pasta sheets, lay out a sheet on a clean surface with a short end facing you. Spoon a heaping 1/4 cupful of the filling so it runs all the way down the center. Roll pasta around the filling to create a 1 1/4 diameter tube. The pasta will overlap quite a bit. Repeat with remaining pasta sheets, arranging in baking dish as you go to create 2 rows. If using shells, spoon a heaping tablespoon of filling into each shell and nestle each next to each other to create rows. You will have five or six shells each. Spread remaining bechamel over cannoli, then marinara sauce. Top with parmesan. Bake the cannelloni until the edges of pasta are lightly browned and the sauce is bubbling around the edges of the pan 30 to 40 minutes. You can do this ahead. Filling can be made 2 days ahead. Let cool completely, then cover and chill. And if you recall that chicken piccata, this makes 4 servings. Lightly flouring the cutlets lets them brown quickly without overcooking and helps thicken the sauce. 2 large skinless, boneless chicken breasts. Some kosher salt. 1/2 cup all-purpose flour. 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, divided. 4 garlic cloves, smashed. 1/3 cup of dry white wine. 1 tablespoon drained capers, coarsely chopped. 4 tablespoons unsalted butter, cut into pieces. And finally, 2 tablespoons fresh lemon juice, and then chopped parsley and lemon wedges for serving. Slice the chicken breast in 1/2 crosswise into 4 cutlets and lightly pound each piece between sheets of plastic wrap until an even thickness, about 1/2 inch thick or less. Season lightly with salt. Place flour in a medium shallow bowl. Working 1 at a time, place cutlets in the bowl and toss to coat in the flour. Knock off the excess flour and transfer to a plate. Heat 2 tablespoons oil in a large skillet over medium heat. Working in batches, if needed to avoid overcrowding the pan, cook cutlets without moving them until deeply browned underneath, about 2 minutes. Turn over and cook on the other side just until chicken is nearly cooked through, about 30 seconds. Whoa. Transfer to a clean plate. Add garlic and remaining 1 tablespoon oil to the skillet and cook, stirring often and reducing the heat if needed to keep garlic from scorching until golden brown, about 2 minutes. Add wine and capers and cook, swirling pan and scraping up any browned bits stuck to the bottom of skillet until the liquid is almost completely separated, about 3 minutes. Add 1/2 cup of water, followed by the butter. Swirl pan vigorously while the butter melts to help it form an emulsion with water, about 1 minute. Return the chicken to skillet and simmer until chicken is cooked through and sauce is thick enough to coat a spoon, about 2 minutes. Remove from heat and stir lemon juice into the sauce. Season with salt. Transfer the chicken and sauce to a platter and top with parsley. Serve with lemon wedges. Whew. Won't that be wonderful? Old school, listen to this, is awesome. Old school tiramisu Ever since I moved to New York City from Buenos Aires 5 years ago, no dish has better represented the city to me than tiramisu. Maybe it's my Italian blood, about 3%. Maybe it's the rich flavor of coffee or the delicate sweetness of ladyfingers. Maybe it's the excuse to have booze in the middle of the day. Whatever the reason, tiramisu is my favorite dessert, and this version nails it. Moist but not wet, extra fluffy with real coffee instead of espresso powder, and the perfect amount of dark rum. No matter what time it is, if there's tiramisu in the test kitchen, you will find me chomping down on a slice. So, old school tiramisu. 8 servings. The trick to getting enough bittersweet coffee flavor into the ladyfingers is dunking them until they are soaked, but removing them just before they start to fall apart. Then you can squish them as needed to fit into the pan. So you're going to need vegetable oil for the pan, 1.5 cups very strong coffee, cooled, 1 tablespoon dark rum, a pinch of kosher salt, 1 tablespoon plus 1/3 cup sugar, 1 cup chilled heavy cream, 1/2 cup mascarpone, 3 large egg yolks, 24 ladyfingers, and then some cocoa powder for dusting. Lightly oil a 9x5 loaf pan and line with plastic wrap, leaving plenty of overhang. Whisk coffee, rum, salt, and 1 tablespoon sugar in a shallow dish until the sugar and salt dissolve. Chill until ready to use. Whisk cream and mascarpone in a medium bowl just until smooth. Set that aside. Pour water into a large saucepan to come 2 inches up the sides and bring to a simmer. Combine egg yolks, remaining 1/3 cup sugar, and 2 tablespoons water in a medium heat-proof bowl. Set the bowl over the pan and reduce the heat to low so the water is at a bare simmer. Using an electric mixer or a large whisk and a friend to fill in when your arm cramps, beat mixture on medium-high until eggs triple in volume and are extremely pale yellow and a mixture forms a slowly dissolving ribbon when drizzled over itself in the bowl, 5 to 7 minutes. Remove the bowl from heat. Using clean beaters or a whisk, beat reserved cream mixture until medium peaks form. Add egg yolk mixture and gently fold until no streaks remain. Working one at a time, dip ladyfingers into chilled coffee mixture and let soak just long enough for them to soften. 1 to 2 seconds per side. Lay 8 cookies in prepared pan. It is okay to smush them in a bit. Spread 1/3 of the filling over. Lay another 8 soaked ladyfingers on top and spread 1/2 of the remaining filling over that. Repeat layers 1 more time with remaining ladyfingers and filling. Cover pan with plastic wrap. Chill tiramisu until firm, at least 6 hours and up to 12 hours. Longer is better. You will get cleaner slices and the layers will be fully set. Invert a small platter or a large plate over the top of the loaf pan. Hold together tightly and flip them over so the plate is underneath. Set on a work surface and carefully remove the pan. Peel away the plastic wrap from the tiramisu. Discard that. Generously dust the tiramisu with cocoa powder. Serve in slices, dusting with more cocoa powder if desired. And to do ahead, tiramisu without cocoa powder can be made 3 days ahead. Keep it chilled. Is that incredible? When you make that, or let's say you just have it. Yes, it will be wonderful. It's so good. And then the photo is, you know, the lady fingers on top. They're totally brown with that cocoa powder. What a great recipe. That could be fun. I'll just finish with this. Of pies, pickles, and too many coasters, our slightly obsessive picks for this month's finest places to eat and drink. I'm only going to read this one thing. There's a beautiful, like, crystal-looking glass plate with this piece of pie. Let me start off by saying I don't really like pie. I do, however, love a crackly-topped brownie, and I can only assume pastry chef Nicole Rucker is also a fan after inhaling a slice of her decadent chocolate chest pie at the charming L.A. all-day cafe called Fiona. Delightfully fudgy and gooey, but not underbaked, with a buttery, thin yet crisp crust, it made a lover out of this former pie hater. So it looks like a piece of pie, but it's actually a very fudgy, delicious brownie, crunchy brownie. Isn't that awesome? And then, of course, there's a big smear of whipped cream on there as well. So, yeah, bon appetit. Absolutely. I think I'm very close to running out of time, so I will stop now and just wish you all, here we are in November, it's turned cold. It had to happen, that's we know. Everyone stay, get out your hats, your coats, gloves, stay warm. This is a time to drink tons of water, you know, hot water, lemon, to stay hydrated. Stay healthy and stay tuned. This is Sue Marks reading today for Food Thoughts. Talk to you all soon. You take care. Bye-bye.